Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program of economic analysis of our jobs, our incomes, trends, the future, debts, all of that, having to do with the production and distribution of the goods and services we all depend on. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. Been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I'll have a little more to tell you about that later in the program. I also want to alert you that we've changed our format a little bit. For those of you that are familiar with the program, it has basically three parts. We begin with short updates for about a quarter of the program. Then I respond to questions from listeners and viewers around the country and indeed around the world. And then in the last half of the program, we go into some special topics in some depth, or we have an interview with an expert guest that I think you will find interesting. So let's get right to it. I want to begin today with the story of Ireland, an important country in the world, but that's doubly important because of the role that it is currently playing. On October 14th of this year, they came in with their new budget, and around that swirled a question that has swirled around Ireland for quite a while. It's the question of taxes. Ireland makes a specialty of offering corporations significantly lower tax rates on their profits than those corporations face in many, many other advanced industrial countries. So, for example, giant corporations like Apple Computer and Google and others have located businesses in Ireland and arranged for their accountings to make their profits show up in Ireland because the tax bite they face there is lower. For example, the corporate tax rate in Ireland is 12.5% of your taxable profits compared to 35% in the United States, and that's more than enough of a difference to make companies move. The Irish are taking advantage of an age-old game. That game exists in many parts of the world. It exists inside the United States, too, where for many, many years, the 50 states compete against one another to get companies to locate there by offering them lower taxes, state taxes, benefits, subsidies, and so forth. Cities in the United States compete with each other that way. So it's not surprising that countries compete that way, too. And I wanted to stress that one of the reasons Ireland is coming out of this great economic crisis rather quickly these days is because it has refused to listen to complaints from other countries, quite a few, that there's something bad for the world in having countries compete. And the truth of it is that they're right. The Irish are not giving up. They're continuing to do it. All of the shenanigans and discussions notwithstanding, the Irish continue to offer extraordinary low taxes. One Deloitte accountant was reported as saying, in effect, in Ireland, you pay about 5%, which is much, much lower than corporations face elsewhere. The argument against this, which I want to repeat so everyone has it in their mind, is simple. If one country does it, it forces all the other countries to not lose or to try not to lose their businesses by competing, by lowering their tax rates so that companies have less of a reason to move to Ireland. And of course, this competition by one country starts off the next one, that leads to the next one, and you have what is called often a race to the bottom. Because where does this end? It ends with country after country lowering its taxes on business for fear of losing the business. And in the end, the businesses, of course, make out like crazy because they play one country against another, much as corporations have played one state or one city inside the United States and inside other countries against one another. This is a process that the politicians, of course, could and should resist. But being as they are so dependent on corporations now more than ever, they make noises about this being unfair. They make noises about the bad results of a race to the bottom. And when the noises are over, they look the other way. And as in Ireland this last month, So it is elsewhere in the United States. The competition of state against state, city against city, country against country, benefiting only the corporations, because of course, as each jurisdiction levies lower taxes on corporations, they're left with two choices. Either to raise the taxes on everybody else, the citizens, the working people, to make up for what they're not taxing the corporations, or, if they don't do that, to have much less money to spend and thereby cutting social services, because again, they fear to cut the taxes on corporations because that'll be another incentive for them to leave. This is an absurd system. It serves only the interests of corporations. It does not serve the interests of the mass of people. And it's long overdue for a serious change, which I don't see. The next update. The next update has to do with Australia. Australia is in the midst of a bevy of court cases. And what are these court cases about? They're about internships. So let's say we all remember what internships have come to mean. Once upon a time, they meant something like being an apprentice. You work somewhere in a special capacity as an intern because it's less important the work that you do and more important the work that you learn how to do. An intern is doing something that will help him or her develop skills, develop expertise, and so on, like an apprentice, like an intern in the medical field, which is where the term used to be most in use. In recent years, businesses have begun to take advantage, to be more honest, abuse this concept. Here's what they do. They say to a young person, look, we'll give you the wonderful opportunity of coming into work here every day, Monday through Friday, for the next few months, maybe even for the next few years. And we're going to call you an intern. And as an intern, we're going to say you're learning things. And because you're here learning, we either pay you very little or increasingly, we pay you nothing at all. And the job market for young people particularly is so poor in the United States, in Europe, and elsewhere, that young people, desperate to get their foot in the door of a potential job, offer themselves up as unpaid or minimally paid interns in the hope, which may or may not be realized, that their internship will turn into a job in several months or in several years. The end result has been corporations have seen a wonderful opportunity to get a small army of free workers doing free labor. And this contradicts many of the labor laws on the books in Australia, in the United States, in the United Kingdom, all over the place. Because after decades of struggle, labor unions won laws in all of these countries making it illegal to underpay, to not properly pay your workers. And internships is simply an excuse to do exactly what the law forbids. Hence the law cases, hence the young people and some not so young people who in a variety of countries, Australia right now in the news, but other countries as well, including the United States, law courts and law cases are being brought in order to show that labor law prohibits what the internship hustle has been doing. And I wanted to add my support to this effort to stop this process because it is such a flagrant abuse, but also to mention that it has serious consequences. A growing number of people are basically working for free. And that is not good for all working people because of the downward pressure it puts on the economy as a whole. Because obviously, if more and more young people, particularly, are working without getting paid, they don't have money to spend, you can see the consequences here are not good. And secondly, there's a flagrant and unjust discrimination going on here. Why? Well, a person who's self-dependent, self-reliant, a young man, a young woman who has to earn his or her way because they've got no other way to pay the rent, pay for the food, and keep themselves alive, they, of course, can't do it. They cannot work for nothing. So who ends up getting a disproportionate share of the internships? The children of the wealthy, the children who can turn to their parents, young people, and get the kind of support for 6 months, a year, 2 years, 4 years. The internships are getting longer because they're so profitable for business. But then you're requiring young people to have their own resources to live near where they work, to pay the rent, to pay their food bills, to keep themselves in warm clothes. They have to rely on friends, neighbors, relatives. So the rich are able to help their children by enabling them to take attractive internships, giving them a leg up on all those who don't have the resources. This is not a level playing field. This is not fair. This is making sure that companies who get away with a semi-legal activity called internships, in the process, give favoritism to those who need it least. It's a way that capitalism works, and it's a way that makes one more reason to be questioning and challenging about it. The next update I want to talk to you about has to do, very brief, it has to do with a letter sent by the Inspector General for the American military effort in Afghanistan, that one of long standing, and it has to do with the $7 billion, according to the U.S. government, that the United States spent to eradicate the poppy crop in Afghanistan. Poppies, as I assume most of you know, are the raw material for opium and all the drugs that are derived from opium, the opiates, they're called. They are a scourge around the world, in many, many parts of the world. Afghanistan was and is the largest single producer of opium through the poppy plant in the world. And the United States was committed, as part of its occupation of Afghanistan, which it is still doing, it was committed to eradicate this scourge of the world. Hence the interesting thing about the report of the Inspector General, a report made to Secretary of State Kerry, Secretary of Defense Hagel, and others, was simply this. The effort, $7 billion worth of it over many years, is a complete and abject failure. How do we know? Because in 2013, the last full year for which we have data, the amount of opium and poppy crop produced in Afghanistan was the greatest in the history of that country. So clearly the eradication effort has failed. As an economics program, why am I interested? Because it's poverty that drives this industry. A disproportionate number of people who turn to opium as an escape from the difficulties of their lives are poor people. And when you look in Afghanistan for who produces the poppy, it is the poor peasants of that country, the farmers. This is their most cash-worthy crop. It's the way they can survive because they can produce it, they know how, they know where, and there's a good market for it. So it's the poverty of the farmers of Afghanistan that drives them to produce the supply of opium. And it's the poverty all over the world that is a major producer of the demand for opium. And so powerful is the poverty around the world, and so powerful, therefore, the drive to produce it and to consume it, that even the most powerful government in the world, occupying the country of Afghanistan day and night, from the air, from the sea, from the ground, willing to budget $7 billion, fails completely to overcome the poverty that other parts of the United States reproduce. All right, a couple of more quick updates. A big change in the American South. Over the years, the American South, trying to become an industrial part of the United States and to overcome its agrarian past, has been very eager to bring in automobile companies, to get the companies from Detroit, General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, to move production down there, but also to get Japanese, German, and other foreign automobile companies to locate plants in their part of the world. And they would advertise, as they often did, that they will give them tax benefits, tax relief, subsidies, and the lower wages of working people in the South compared to what they were in the Northeast and the Midwest of the United States. And one of the companies that took up the blandishments of the South was the Volkswagen Corporation, Germany's largest producer of automobiles. But the German automobile companies, like German companies in general, operate in a different way from American companies. Turns out there are different kinds of capitalism and different kinds of capitalist enterprises. German companies, under enormous pressure from their own working classes, the German working class having a very powerful trade union movement and having political parties that it is closely tied to, like the Socialist Party and the Left Party in Germany, that push the interests and have seats in parliament, German capitalism is different. German capitalists regularly meet with and consult with workers. The adversarial situation between capitalists and workers in Germany is like it is anywhere in capitalism. They are always trying to find ways to make more money and to do it at the expense of the workers, but they have been constrained by workers. And for example, if you're a company over 2,000 employees in Germany, almost half your board of directors, your decision makers, have to be chosen by the workers, a thought beyond the imagination of most American capitalists. German capitalists meet with their workers all the time to hear their grievances. In addition to the trade union, they have a worker council that also has all kinds of authority in relationship to the fact. None of that exists in the United States in general. But VW is going to do it in the American South, starting in Tennessee. And that's good news for the workers in the United Auto Workers and other unions, because in effect, what VW is saying is, we want a different, much less confrontational relationship with our unions than Americans are used to. Americans are horrified. They don't want to consider that there's an alternative form of capitalism that isn't as unequal as that in the United States. Presidents and corporate executives in Germany make much more than workers, but not as much more as Americans do. And so there's great consternation in the conservative circles in the South that the VW Corporation is instituting German-style labor relations in their American plants. What did they think? That you'd bring the VW business here and they would have to get rid of what has worked for them? Let's remember, in the German economy, the last 5 years have been one of declining unemployment, extraordinary economic well-being, much better than the experience here in the United States with the more unequal and more abrasive kind of capitalism. Just like other systems, capitalists can be different among themselves. It will be very interesting to see how the German type of cooperative capitalism with its workers succeeds or doesn't in the competition compared to the more unequal and more harsh and abrasive kind of capitalism here. Last short item. Well, once again, this last week, big banks got into trouble, had to pay fines, this time $4.25 billion. And what is it they got caught doing this time? Well, let me list you the banks so you know which ones they are. The United Bank of Switzerland, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, HSBC, and Royal Bank of Scotland. Together paid $4.25 billion, this time for manipulating the foreign currency market. You know, every day, $5 trillion worth of currencies are exchanged. People with dollars get euros, people with euros get Japanese yen, and so on. And the banks are the ones that handle those transactions, and they've been caught manipulating the market illegally, immorally, unethically. You know, this is a long list. The banks over the last couple of years have paid billions in fines for money laundering criminal money, for manipulating interest rates, the so-called LIBOR scandal, for charging fees to customers they had no right to do, and for the enormous mortgage scam, where they misprocessed the mortgages, where they pushed mortgages on people without them being properly informed, where they didn't collect properly. So here it is, yet another prosecution, yet another fine, and we're not heard the end of this. The investigations and currency manipulation are just getting underway. And on the front page of the New York Times, on the 13th of November, guess what? Turns out that large American banks have been systematically hounding people for debts that those people didn't have anymore. These turn out to be people who went through the legal bankruptcy process, which erases your debts. And the banks are supposed to do what the courts decree when they grant a bankruptcy. But it turns out that the banks have been hounding people even when they were not obligated to pay, and they've gotten money out of people who actually had no legal obligation. Yet another scandal. No banker has been put into jail for these things. No bank has been fined anything that would make any difference to their basic economic well-being. We're slapping them all on the wrist instead of facing the fact that every unethical and illegal act a bank could have been caught for, it has been caught for. The biggest banks have shown their willingness to do everything we think they ought not to do and that the law prohibits them from doing. And still, we are hamstrung in the United States. We can't say, gee, the banks have forfeited their rights to be a private enterprise. They have abused their position. And banking should be taken over by the government, so at least it's transparent and accountable in a way that might hold it back from these kinds of behaviors, because clearly private banking can't meet the most basic standard. Let me turn then, as we do in the second part of the opening of the program, to responding to some of your questions. Great questions as usual, and let me urge you to continue, please, to send them to us because we are more than interested in them. First question is outsourcing only something that happens in the sense of companies leaving the United States, moving jobs out of the United States and locating them instead in some other part of the world, in China and India and Brazil or wherever? Or is there something called domestic outsourcing? The answer is yes, there is something called domestic outsourcing. Basically, it means the same thing. It means closing down a job, a set of jobs, in an industry, in an office, in a store, and moving to another part of the United States to take advantage of cheaper labor in that other place. Or sometimes you don't even move your place. You just move jobs out of the hands of people who've been earning, let's say, $20 an hour, and move them into another part of your community where you can pay $15 an hour. Let me give you an example. In many cities, towns, communities, public employees who have earned over the years a rising standard of living, maybe making, let's say, I don't know, $18 an hour, I'll use the example that's quite famous these days, a person who drives a school bus gets paid $18 an hour. And along comes a mayor looking to make political headlines or another politician and says, why are we paying $18 an hour? We can get temp workers, people who come through a temporary labor agency, for example, to do this job for $13 an hour. And I'm going to realize this saving for the taxpayer. Lots of hoop-de-doodle, lots of public relations, lots of cameras catching this cost-saving event. This is outsourcing. You're basically sourcing out the public employee job, firing that person, laying him or her off, losing the $18 an hour job, and you're hiring a temp worker for $13. Is this a cost saving? Is this a good idea? Well, it may be a cost saving, but it's a long way between that and a good idea. Let me give you the example. In many cases, The school bus driver, to stay with that example, is the same man or woman who drives the school bus every day. He or she gets to know the students. He or she develops a relationship with the students. He notices if there's a problem and can alert the teacher. He notices if there's a problem on the way home and can alert the parents. He can use his cell phone. He can do, or she can do, all kinds of things. When you move to a temp worker, the temp agency may send you a different person from time to time. That person is less invested in this job because that's what a temp agency does, provide you with a temporary job. Your whole attitude towards the job is different. Yeah, you pay a few dollars, but in terms of how your child is treated, in terms of the relationships on that bus, in terms of the commitment and investment, you may be saving $3 or $4 an hour, and you may be taking a chance you will kick yourself for the rest of your life, having to do with how you cared for or arranged for your children. It's that way every other job category. When someone says they've saved money, it's all on a job. It's always important to ask, what's the difference in the quality of the job holder, of the job done, of the whole feeling of the job? You don't get nothing for nothing, as my uncle used to say. You cut the wages of workers, you pay a price. You don't just save money. Other things change too, and it's your own danger if you don't ask about it. Second, people have asked me to provide a rationale, which I want to do in the next few minutes, to worker self-directed enterprises, the kind of organization or reorganization of enterprises that I find so attractive and so important for the United States to work with. This is a way of organizing a business in which the workers themselves become their own bosses. It becomes their company, their office, their store, their factory. They become people who all have two job descriptions. On the one hand, they do a particular task, the way they always did. But on the other hand, they're also part, together with every other worker, of the directorship of the company. Every week, they have to have meetings, like a board of directors would, where they make the big decisions, what the company produces, how it produces, how they do their work, where they do their work, and what they do with the profits that they all help to produce when the company is successful. Why am I in favor of this? Well, the arguments are many, but I want to give you one rationale because several of you have asked me to emphasize this. I believe in democracy, and I think most of the people listening to this program share that belief, as do many, many people around the world. That is, we believe that democracy is a good rule to live by. If you are affected by a decision, that's what democracy means, then you have to be part of making the decision. The absence of democracy, whether we call that autocracy or monarchy or whatever else we want to call it, the absence of democracy is the opposite. That's when you have to live with a decision, but you are not given any power, any participation in making that decision. I'm against autocracy. I'm in favor of democracy. And because I feel that way, I want to institute, I want to apply democracy where I work. Why? Because that's where I spend most of my adult life. 5 out of 7 days, all the best hours of those 5 days, I'm at work. If democracy is something I value, it ought to be at work. If democracy is something we value in the communities where we live, we institute a democratic politics. We don't have a king, we don't have a dictator. Then why, I would ask you, do we allow when we go to work that we have precisely that, a dictator? A boss who tells us how to work, where to work, when to work, who tells us when we're fired and have no job and have no income, who can close down the workplace and open it across town, across the country, across the world, completely transforming not just our jobs and lives and incomes, but that of our community. Why do we permit all of those decisions to be made by people over whom we have no power? That's not democracy, that's the opposite. And if we're going to ever seriously call ourselves a democratic country, we would have to reorganize the way we do business. No more top-down corporations run by shareholders and a board of directors they select. That's not democratic. Have the businesses run by the people who depend on them, by the people in the communities around them who live from these institutions. Otherwise, don't pretend we have a democracy. We've come to the end of the first half of Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. Before we break for a very few seconds, and I hope you come back with us, I want to again remind you, as we always do at this point in the program, that we maintain two websites, rdwolff.com and Democracy at Work, that's all one word, democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites contain information expanding on everything we do in this program. We urge you to take a look of them. They're available 24/7 at no charge whatsoever. They allow you to communicate with us and to follow us on Facebook, Pinterest, and Twitter. We'll be back in a very few seconds for the second half of this program.
I left the house, left the room with a fox hay on my back and my supplies in a magic pack, and I followed the sound of music, not up a hill, but down to an old wharf shack. Inside I heard the trumpets call, a salute to the champions on the wall, and in the jazz of squalls and in passion brawls she danced. Oh, and the night she looked so fine to me. Wagon fish, it's a to my hook.
Welcome back, friends, to the second half of Economic Update. I want to welcome you as the host, Richard Wolff, and explain again that in our new format, this second half of the program allows me to go into some major issues in some depth. They're not short updates, and they're not immediate responses to a question, although one of the reasons we encourage you to go to the two websites we maintain and to send us your comments and questions is that we use them to decide what topics to cover in this section, the more in-depth section, and how to cover them in order to serve your interests. Okay, many of you have contacted me and want me to, again, even though I've done it before, and I appreciate this, this is perfectly reasonable, to go over the history of the economic crisis that we're still in. And so, even though repetition is sometimes burdensome, maybe it'll be in interest to enough of you, certainly your emails to us suggest it, to go over it again. So here we go. I won't spend time on the causes of the crisis, but mainly focus myself on what happened starting in 2008 when this crisis hit, when suddenly banks shut down, when suddenly millions of people were thrown out of work, that had nothing to do with their capacity or the quality of their work, excuse me, or the effort they made. It had to do with an economy that was collapsing and that had no more purchasing power to buy whatever people were producing. So millions were laid off. Capitalist economies around the world basically collapsed. And in that situation, all the major banks, the ones that earlier in this program we acknowledged as having committed yet more punishable behavior, having to pay yet more fines for yet more of the illegal acts that they perpetrate upon the body politic, upon all of us. These banks were destroyed. They were bankrupt. They had made terrible speculations. They had lent money to people who couldn't pay back, which is the first thing a banker is trained not to do. They had done all that, and now they were kaput. And so they went to governments around the world. American banks went to the American government, British banks to the British government, Germans and Japanese corporations and banks to their governments. They all did the same thing. Bail us out. Help us out. We're collapsing. And the veiled threat that they all issued was, you better help us, you government, because if we really are allowed to fall apart, The way, for example, the government let Lehman Brothers, a huge American investment bank, early in this process, let it go, let it collapse, then we will take the whole economy with us. Very clear threat. You must bail us out, because if you don't, the whole economic system will collapse, and then we'll all be in the soup. The terrified government officials everywhere basically caved in, as the banks clearly knew they would. That one effort to let Lehman Brothers go, and a little bit earlier Bear Stearns go, was so scary as to the way it shook the economy that they didn't have to threaten again. They got what they wanted. So here's what happened. Governments around the world spent, ready, trillions of dollars bailing out the banks. And when they discovered other kinds of corporations also about to collapse, where that also would have had terrible effects, like the AIG Insurance Corporation, like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the special agencies that back up mortgages in the United States, like General Motors, they bailed them out too. They spent trillions, as I say. Some of it was money they literally printed. That was the role of the Federal Reserve. And some of it was money that the federal government spent, which it borrowed in order to be able to spend. That's called running a deficit when the government borrows. Why did the government borrow to bail out the banks? For fear that if they taxed American citizens or taxed American businesses to get the money to bail out the banks, that would save the banks, but it would put the citizens and the businesses into such trouble that that would keel us over and put us in the soup. So the solution was borrow the money. As soon as the borrowed money, plus the money printed by the Federal Reserve or made available to banks electronically, which is the way the Federal Reserve works, as soon as the banks were back on their feet, as soon as the big corporations got bailed out, the people who had lent the money to the government, which are, by the way, the same corporations and the same banks, the people who had lent the money to the government that the government gave them to bail them out, were concerned that they be paid back properly. So they didn't want the conversation in America and in other countries to be, wow, how do you get people back to work? How do you make a defunct capitalism function again for people? No, no, no. That question was put aside once the people who brought us the crisis were bailed out by the government. They wanted a new issue to be put forward. The debts. Look at all the debts the governments have run up. They have to do something. The people who said, wait a minute, you didn't worry about the debt when you went to get the government to give you the money they had to borrow for. You weren't worried then. Now you're worried. Yeah, because we got bailed out. We used the money that the government gave us to lend back to the government, because it's the only safe thing to do with money these days. So now we're worried about the government's debt, and therefore everybody has to be. And if you're going to be worried about the government's debt, if you don't want them to be jacking up more debt, because that might make your debt a little more insecure because the debtor is becoming deeper and deeper into debt, how do you cut back on government debts? It's called austerity. You either raise taxes on the people, the way, for example, Obama in the spring, in the winter of 2013, returned the payroll tax way up to what it had been before the crisis hit. You raise taxes on people because then the government doesn't have to borrow so much. Or you spend less on schools and hospitals, and that's what the American government did, and many other governments. That's what austerity meant. Suddenly the problem becomes the deficit. Well, it turns out when you tax your people more and you spend less, you hurt the economy. That is, you don't hurt the big banks so much, you don't hurt the big corporations, but you hurt the average people who are the ones who pay those taxes and who are the ones who need those government services the most. So we've had 7 years of economic crisis that's not going away. Wages have remained stagnant. Even the boasting in the United States that our unemployment is going down, that's explained by the fact that large numbers of our workers are leaving the labor force. They're giving up. And those who are getting jobs at much lower pay, much lower security, many fewer benefits than what they had, which means the downward pressure on our economy is maintained even when people come back to work, because they come back to work under such worse circumstances. That's the reality of what has happened. This was a crisis brought to us by the people who run our capitalist system. They love to get praise when they're the captains of industry. But when the captain has run the ship into the shoals, when the ship is keeling over, they want to find some other conversation. They don't want to be told, oh, well, you were in charge when it was going real well. You're to blame when it isn't. Oh, no, it's something else. It's poor people who shouldn't have taken out a mortgage. A mortgage you, the banker, gave them and pushed on them. And we hear all these silly stories. They just don't want to be accountable and responsible for the damage they did. But it's worse. When they got us into this disaster that they don't want to be held accountable for, they ran to the government to bail them out. The government they've always denounced was the government they turned to save them. And no sooner had the government borrowed huge amounts of money to save them, then we were told the government is not solvent. The government is too deep in debt. Wait a minute. The people who are telling us that are the people whose demands on the government created the crisis in government debt that they talk about. And so now we have austerity to deal with the debt. Do you notice anything here? What they want, the people who run the corporations and the banks, what they want runs the show. And the rest of us are told to live with it, to absorb it. And this will continue, because the message sent by the last 6 years of crisis, the message sent to the people who run this economy is, do what you want, make money in any way you see fit. If we catch you doing something illegal, you'll get a slap on the hand. And if we don't catch you, we'll bail you out when you go too far. And the mass of people will sit by and do this. And they won't make much noise. And they won't stand in the way. Are we then going to be really surprised if all of this happens again and soon? We shouldn't be. It's the history of this crisis. The next topic I want to go into in some detail with you, if you bear with me, has to do with a remarkable study. I don't often tell you about particular studies that I use in compiling these programs. But I want to talk to you about two studies that came across my desk in the last week, because I think they reveal important things about our economic system, particularly in this case, the system here in the United States. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, one of the greatest basketball players in the history of the game, wrote a remarkable article that appeared on the 12th of November, 2014, in the internet magazine Jacobin. And you can find this at jacobinmag.com. JACOBINMAG, jacobinmag.com. The title of the article by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is College Athletes of the World Unite. And basically, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar takes us back to his days as a star in in college basketball. And he wants us to understand the gross injustice that college athletes are given limited scholarships. They are not paid hardly at all. Meanwhile, the coaches who coach them and the university presidents who sit at the top of this pyramid are making wild amounts of money. He mentions, for example, talking about March Madness, the culmination of the college season this year in 2014, that the NCAA, that's the association that runs all of this, raked in nearly $1 billion of revenue from March Madness, that the president of the NCAA, National Collegiate Athletic Association, made $1.7 million, that the 10 highest paid coaches in this year's March Madness earned annual salaries ranging from $2.6 million a year to $9.7 million a year. All of that depends on college athletes who are given virtually none of that, whose scholarships are not even adequate to maintain their basic condition, who are not allowed to go out and get other sources of income the way those coaches are. It's a very ugly story of injustice that is very damaging to college athletes. And Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is very clear in a short article on how stark this injustice is. But I'm not just interested in the injustice that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar notes in this Jacobin magazine article. I want to stress where this comes from. Where does it come into the mind of a university, a president, to make this kind of money, to pay the coach millions and millions of dollars, and to be so stingy, so unsupportive of the college athletes who are the ones who make it possible? And I think the answer is that they are following the model of what a capitalist corporation is, because that is the model for our society, isn't it? Those are the heroes, the well-paid, the super-rich, the entrepreneurs we celebrate. And how do they organize their companies that we all depend on, that we all see, whose advertisements we're confronted with every day 1,000 times? They organize by paying their top people wild amounts of money and nickel and diming everybody else every chance they get. So why are we surprised that the university athletic system does it the same way? Pays people at the top wild amounts of money and the middle not so much, and the people at the bottom, the people who actually make it all happen, the workers without whom nothing would happen. Not in the Coca-Cola company, not in the Google company, not in any of the workers who do the work are the ones who find themselves on the short end of the stick. But the people at the very top, they are walking away with a fortune. And it's sad to watch that what the model is in the corporation infects all the other parts of society, our sports, our entertainment, our churches. Once again, pay wildly at the top and be all concerned about efficiency everywhere else. The second article that I want to bring to your attention is an article produced by two university professors, Martin Gillens, G-I-L-E-N-S, and Benjamin Page. They have an article in the fall 2014 issue of the academic journal Perspectives on Politics. And here's what their article, which is, I'm going to give you the title in a moment, here's what their article is about. They did a study of the influence exercised on our legislators in this country. Does the government cater to elite groups? Does it cater to the average citizen? And they looked at what elite groups wanted the government to do. By elite groups, by the way, they mostly mean business groups, because however you define elite groups, groups that are groups of enterprises, of capitalist businesses, are the major in the number, in the amount of money they have to spend, and so on. So they compared influence of basically business elite groups on government decisions versus popular opinion versus the opinion of average citizens. And this is a scholarly study done by two professors. Professor Gillens is at Princeton. Professor Page is at Northwestern University outside of Chicago. So these are very legitimate, very mainstream political scientists. But their research results is something I want you to think about. They basically say, and I urge you to take a look at the article, the title of which is Testing Theories of American Politics, Elites, Interest Groups, and Average Citizens. Well, there's the title, Gillens and page in the 2014 fall edition of the journal Perspectives on Politics. For those of you who might make a note, it's volume 12, number 3 of that journal. They find that the United States is not a democracy when it comes to who wields the influence on the government. Its average citizens have next to no influence, and the business elite groups that they've documented following them in detailed examinations for many years are the people who run it. Basically, here's what they conclude. Quote, the preferences of economic elites have far more independent impact on policy change than the preferences of average citizens do. Sure, I know. Many of you say, we knew that already. And I don't doubt that you did, and that's important. But it is also important when finally something understood by average citizens percolates its way up into the ranks of those who have spent so much of their time, and that's a fair criticism of the academic community, missing the boat, apologizing for the system, celebrating details that obscure the underlying realities, being afraid even to ask these kinds of questions. Now, finally, a growing number of professionals are saying what we all know, that whatever this country's past may have been, and we can argue about that, here, now, today, we don't live in a democracy. We live in an autocracy or an oligarchy, as many of the people studying this paper have concluded, an oligarchy of big business. They call the shots, they shape the policy, and we all pretend that we don't quite see it, or it isn't quite so bad, or maybe it isn't quite so true. But here it is. Take a look at the article if you have a chance. Perspectives on Politics is the journal. It's worth going through it. And one result? Well, if you have an oligarchy of business interests, and if neither of your two major parties are willing to face that, to call it what it is, to debate whether it's consistent with our values as a society, then why are we surprised, as the New York Times seemed to be, in its editorial on November 12th, when it said, we had the lowest turnout in these midterm elections of any election in 72 years. The overwhelming majority of Americans eligible to vote did not do so. And I think the answer is here. The big questions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, our future, our children's future, everything economics that this program deals with is on the line. And the two major parties who are going to put the people in office who make the decisions, who write the laws, who pass the bills, they don't say a word about it. They don't deal with this problem. They don't recognize an oligarchy because they're part of it. They've been bought. It's obvious. We all know it. That's what this scholarly article documents. Are we going to continue to let these leaders lead, to let these controllers control, to let them take us from one speculation bubble to the next, from one crisis to the next, from one austerity policy to the next? Really? Is that what a stand-up American citizen or British citizen or German citizen or Australian citizen or anybody else wants to think of himself or herself in the morning? It's an important question to ask. All right, folks. We've come to the end of another program. I had wanted to give you one more topic. I'm going to have to be very, very brief because of our time. The Greek government may soon change. a radical political party, Syriza, led by Alex Tsipras, may come to power if elections are held soon. At least that's what the polls suggest. And one of the things that party advocates is to eliminate its debts. It does not want to have debts to the rest of the world that were incurred by governments that did not represent the people in their view. And they make an interesting argument recently that I want to bring to your attention. They want to know, why is the West, Britain, the United States, France, Japan, why aren't they willing to cancel debts of third world countries, of countries in great difficulty like Greece? And they say, we ask the question because in 1953, you did cancel the debts of another country. The country was Germany. The country in 1953 that had just come through the Nazi period, the country blamed for unspeakable atrocities, for causing World War II. This country was given the abrogation of its debts. Most of its debts were canceled. Why? To make them a strong enemy of the Soviet Union at the time. That was clear. And apparently, there's no comparable reason to help the much larger number of people affected by the debts of third world countries and poor countries like Greece. Powerful question. It's going to be on the agenda soon. This is Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my life. And I ask you, please, as we close this program, to make use of our websites, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info. I want to thank truthout.org, a courageous, independent source of news and analysis. They're a worthwhile place to go. Take a look at them, truthout.org. I want to thank the team of people that work with me, and I want to thank the radio stations and television stations that use and broadcast this program. This is a cooperative effort to bring you new, different, and extraordinarily important news and information and analysis. Thank you very much for your support, both for the radio stations and for our efforts, which you can find out more about at the website. I look forward to talking with you again next week.